You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week on Mysteries and Monsters, we return to the world of the paranormal with author and stage manager Nick Bromley. Nick's book, Stage Ghosts and Haunted Theatres, is a marvellous collection of first-hand accounts of the paranormal drawn from theatres across the United Kingdom. Nick and I battled through a thunderstorm during our interview to discuss the murder of William Terrace and his ghost, the aggressive spirit that terrified a cleaner at the location of the musical Wicked, a jacket with murderous intentions, a flying picture, and the King of Clowns, Grimaldi. Despite the numerous technical issues we faced, we delve into some spooky stories, which I hope you enjoy. A big thank you, as always, for my guest, Nick Bromley, for joining me on this week's show. As always, you can support the show by signing up for Patreon in the show notes for $4 a month, for ad-free episodes, early access, and bonus content through the Paranormal Archive. Mysteries and Monsters is available across all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can subscribe to our channel on YouTube. And also you can find the website at mysteriesandmonsters.com. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his artwork. Brennan Storr is the producer from the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is pleased to be part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, despite this week's episode making me feel like I needed an exorcism, thanks to all the gremlins we faced, let's draw the curtain back on some of Britain's most haunted stages. On today's show, I am delighted to welcome author and West End company stage manager Nick Bromley to the show. Nick has recently released Stage Ghosts and Haunted Theatres, a wonderfully enthralling collection of stories and first-hand accounts from numerous British theatres. Nick, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Good evening, Paul, and how are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
Very well indeed, thank you. Very well indeed. On this chilly night.
Yes, where's summer gone?
Ah, indeed, indeed.
Nick, as we were talking before we dove into the show, I was blown away by your book. I really, really was. And I'm not just saying that because you're kind enough to fit me into your schedule. One of the things that really interests me is theatre and the stage in Britain, because we have such a long tradition of it going back centuries and numerous knights of the realm and dames and such like who have tread the boards across centuries for us. How did you become involved and fall in love with the theatre? Because obviously you've spent the best part of your life working in this environment.
Paul, I'm afraid so. I come from on one side of my family, from the theatrical side, on my mother's side. My mother was in the theatre. She was a dancer. My aunt was an actor and a casting director. Two of my cousins were actors. And it seemed to be a sort of natural thing to do when I'd failed at everything else. So, having decided that it was quite a good idea to do, I went to the Central School of Speech and Drama, which is in London.
Yes.
And in those days, it wasn't royal. It hadn't been given that epithet, as it were. But the thing was, I've got a very bad memory. And so I thought the best thing to do is I'd never be able to learn, silent plays just don't work very well. So I decided to go into stage management because everything could be written down. And that's what I concentrated on and what I stayed in throughout my theatrical career. I haven't quite finished it, I hope, because now I'm looking after dead actors. But apart from that, it's been a long time. So I started I went to Central about 1963. And then in those days, it was a much smaller profession than it is now. Musical theatre was not the dominating force of British theatre. It was very much plays. And so when in those days, being a much smaller number of people in the business, when you've been to somewhere like RADA or Lambda or Central, you were, and it was a closed shop. I must stress that. So you had to be a member of the Actors' Equity Trade Union to be able to work in the theatre professionally. Mm. So if you went to one of the accredited drama schools, you could, at the end of it, you were pretty well guaranteed a job because there weren't many of you. And so I think 10 of us finished the course. It was a 2-year course. Some dropped out, some left, and a few stayed on, including myself. And I got a job at Malvern, which is a festival theatre.
Hmm.
The Malvern Theatre. I don't know if you heard of it, but in the 1930s, it was very interesting because it was where there was a festival started by Barry Jackson from the Birmingham Theatre, and Shaw and Priestley plays were premiered there.
Hmm.
And then the war came along and it fell into abeyance, and then it restarted in 1965. And I was there for the opening season of the new Festival Theatre. And it was put on by a man called Arnold Ridley, who was a very good director. And he, because of the Shaw and the Priestley connection, we worked in repertoire, if you know the expression. So we had four plays, which when they were on, they played a week, then another one would start. And then we'd build up a repertoire of shows. Twice a week, you'd do one play, another time. So it would go on like that throughout the summer.
Mm.
And idyllic summer.
Mm.
Pretty boisterous, actually, because there hadn't been a festival there for, 20 years.
Yes.
And so we were fated by all the local farmers. And and there were a lot of farmers in those days. And theatre people are said to be wild, but I can tell you British farmers just, take the absolutely floor us with their wildness. There was even one party when they brought a bull into the party. Literally. I will say no more. Anyway, we all got tossed out of Malvern, and then I started as I was an ASM then, and then I joined a tour, and it was everyone will have heard of My Fair Lady.
Yes.
And it had just finished at Drury Lane, and it was out on the road going round. In fact, it was so popular there were two productions going round at the same time. Which sounds extraordinary. There was a Southern company and a National company, and I was the National company, although the Southern company got the best dates.
Yes.
And we toured all over England, from Newcastle down to Portsmouth, ending up in Norwich eventually.
Mm.
And it was then that I began to collect stories and associations with theatres,
yes.
Not so much with ghosts. I had always been interested in ghosts, but that's another story. But I began to collect stories about theatres in general.
Mm.
When the tour eventually ended, I came back to London, and I was very lucky because the same management were putting on its HM Tennants, who Binky Beaumont was the, some of your listeners may have heard of him. He was the czar, as it were, of the West End in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. They were beginning to come to the end, but they had almost a virtual monopoly of theatre in those early days. I was lucky enough to get they needed someone at the Haymarket Theatre, the Theatre Royal Haymarket, because they had a production coming in of, it was The Rivals, which was by Sheridan, and it was Ralph Richardson and Margaret Rutherford were the leads.
Mm.
Daniel Massey, there were others. There was Angela Thorne, Celia Bannerman, Murray Watson, a great cast of, beautiful actors, especially Sir Ralph and Dame Margaret.
Yes.
And the company manager for it was an extraordinary gentleman called, very famous in theatre, in the theatre world of those times, called Anthony Sharday, very dapper, short man, always immaculate. Everyone wore suits in those days, suits and ties. Dinner jackets, of course, on the front.
Mm.
And he was so good, he looked after two or three shows at the same time. He'd flipped from theatre to theatre.
Mm.
But it was across the road was the Haymarket, is of course in the Haymarket. And the stage door is in Suffolk Street, just behind. And in those days, there used to be an actor's... The West End was quite different from what it is now. But there used to be an actor's club, one of the first of its kind, purely for actors, called the Buxton Club, named after Mr. Buxton, who had been the Victorian manager and playwright and manager and actor at the Haymarket. He was Queen Victoria's favourite actor. And there was a bar, of course, and so you'd go down there after the show, not before, of course, after the show, and you know, you could drink there till midnight in those days, and that was late in those days. And Tony was down there one night sipping he liked a brandy, if I remember, brandy, and for his heart. And I was on a small beer, and we were talking about the Haymarket, and he related the story that he had been on a previous show, which was not The Rivals, it was The School for Scandal, another Sheridan piece. And he'd been to a party, and he had forgotten his overcoat, which was up in the wardrobe. He'd left it in the wardrobe for the wardrobe mistress to sew a button on. So about one in the morning, left downstairs where the party was, walked up eight flights of stairs to the top level, because wardrobes are generally on the top level of any theatre. Sort of Sod's Law, really. And was walking along the corridor, and it was a very old-fashioned theatre, the Haymarket, in those days. It was individually owned, and it didn't have, for example, it didn't have a tannoy system. So that if you were an actor, you had no idea what was going on stage, apart from the lifeline was a knock on the door, and a little voice would say, "Mr. Beale, your call, please, your call." And you'd hear the call, and you'd go downstairs, ready to be on the side of the stage. So it was as old as that, basically. So, but because of the improvements in, of course, the great fear of theatre, the great enemy of theatre, of course, is fire.
Yes.
And they had in, or even in those days, they had fire doors, very strong, of course, covered in asbestos, but they were doors which would not open. They were really heavily hinged. And as he came up the stairs, this is very long-winded, I do apologise, he came up the stairs, and he was walking along to the wardrobe room itself, along the corridor. The fire door in front of him just opened and then closed, and there was no one there to open or close it. He looked at it, he was just amazed, and he tried to make it open, because there was no one on that floor at all. Would not do it. So he related the story. That was his ghost story from the Haymarket. And I thought, this is fantastic. So I wrote that down at the time in a little notebook. And from then on, I thought, this is very interesting. I think I should start collecting any more I hear of, as it were. And that's really started me off on collecting theatre ghost stories.
Yeah. I think the thing about theatres is, Nick, that they're often... actors in general are a very superstitious bunch regardless.
Oh, yes.
But it seems that whether it's because of the performances and the emotion and the hysteria and the excitement that audience would often partake in when they're enjoying a variety of plays and musicals and whatever, that for a lot of people, I think it makes a lot of sense that if anywhere is going to be haunted, it is going to be a theatre because of the incidents that occur and people watch on a regular basis. So I'm not surprised that you've managed to collate such a wonderful collection of these stories. And as we've said, a lot of these are first-hand that have been told to yourself over the years, aren't they?
Well, that's what I have specialised in, because I'm no scientist at all, and I thought that the best way for myself to record, you know, impressions of ghosts is to get the stories from people whose stories I could believe in, whose stories. Now, I'm not saying that every story is absolutely genuine in the fact that it is a ghost, but the people who told it to me, I have fully believed their sincerity in the truth of their story. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't go around with cameras or sensors or thermometers. I don't think I'd be any good at it. For a start, I witness our telephone call tonight. You know, I have pressed the wrong button. So I thought this is the best way, and it's to record stories of people who a lot of the stories I've collected are not from stars. They're from all types of people who work in the theatre. Be they ushers, be they wardrobe, be they stage managers, be they actors. Of course, I do have quite a few acting stories, but it's a potpourri of the business.
Well, I think that's what gives it a lot of credence as well, Nick. Because if it was just famous celebrities or actors or people of that ilk, then perhaps people would tend to view it in a very different light. Whereas, as you refer to, it is a real mixture of people from all walks of theatre life. You've got front of house, you've got wardrobes, dancers, performers, stage managers, security, guests even that have been there. And therefore, for me, that's what really gives it a resonance, because there is such a wide variety of people that are included in this book that it gives it a real depth.
Yes, I think it does. And it demonstrates that ghosts aren't prejudiced. They'll appear to anybody, not just the stars.
Absolutely. Even ghosts enjoy an audience, Nick.
Indeed.
So, at the beginning, you've basically covered several famous venues across London and out into the provinces, as we like to be known. Well, living in Sheffield, we're very fortunate, Nick, because we've got two marvellous theatres.
You've got a really good theatre. Yes, we've got
both the Lyceum and the Crucible.
Very important.
Absolutely. And the strange thing about that is, here in Sheffield, the Lyceum has a history of haunting, the Crucible doesn't.
And I apologise for not touching on the Lyceum. that'll be in volume two.
I was going to say I'll let you off as long as you include it in the second volume, which I do look forward to. I do hope you do pull one together.
I try. I'm researching at the moment, as it were.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to that. But as I said, you've kind of broken down and looked at some of the famous incidents and witness reports that you've been given from these various venues. And obviously, you start off at the Adelphi, which features a case which I was aware of prior to reading your book, primarily because of the person involved, which is the terrible murder of the legendary actor William Terriss. Now, for anybody who doesn't know about William Terriss, Nick, what happened?
Well, it's a very sad story, and it's melodramatic, but then it was the era of the melodrama, and in fact, Terriss was the king of melodrama.
Mm.
William Terriss, Bill, Billy, Sailor Bill, Breezy Bill, was one of the, what's the best word? He was a matinee, he was the original, one of the original matinee idols. He was, of course, Victorian, and of course, matinee idols you think of more for the 1920s, 1930s.
Mm.
And for those who don't know matinees, as it were, in those days you'd have a matinee on maybe even two a week. You'd have even three a week. You'd have a midweek matinee. You'd have a Saturday matinee, usually at about 2:30, 3 o'clock. And if it was really popular, they'd drop in another one.
Mm.
And the ladies, if they enjoyed a gentleman actor, they would come and see him, and he would become, you know, if he stirred a few hearts, he would become a matinee idol.
Mm.
And you could always tell if he was really successful, because in the interval, they used to do matinee teas, a lot of the theatres.
Mm.
I don't know if you know this. And the ladies would pre-order their matinee teas.
Yeah.
And in the beginning of the interval, lots of usherettes would suddenly appear, and ushers, of course, but mostly usherettes in those days. They were slightly more nimble and less drunk than the ushers. And they would bring on a tray, and on it would be a little teapot, or, you know, cup and saucer, a little bit of milk, maybe even a biscuit or two. And these would be passed along to whichever seat. It was very well organized for a shilling or 1 and 6. And then at the end of the matinee, sorry, the interval, they'd be swept away, as it were, by the usherettes again. But if there was a particularly good matinee idol on, I mean, all sorts of terrible things would happen. You know, teapots would be broken, cups would be thrown in the air. It was a mess backstage in the auditorium. So anyway, terrorists had this effect. He was very athletic. He was a sort of, well, best way to describe him, trying to describe him something. He was a, not an Errol Flynn. Well, he had sex appeal. He had sex appeal, I think. Best way to describe it. And he also worked legitimately with Irving's company, Henry Irving's company at the Lyceum, and with Ellen Terry. But then he became a star in his own rights and became the star of a series of melodramas which played at the Adelphi for the vast majority of them.
Mm.
And in those days, you had, apart from the cast of a theatre, you also had the extranumeraries, the extras, the supers, supernumeraries. And these would be minor actors or what we call extras today, who would be grafted in, as they do still at the opera house. You know, you have crowd scenes, you have supernumeraries who come on to fill up the stage. And this happened regularly with melodramas. Say you were doing a big Roaritanian ballroom scene. Well, you couldn't just have two or three dancers. You needed 20. So you'd go and hire some supers. And basically a failed actor. And his name was Richard Archer Prince. And tragic, really. He came from up north on the northeast of England. His sister was a tart playing the gallery, or playing walking the gallery in Leicester Square, mm-hmm. in one of the theatres. And he thought he was a very good actor, and of course he wasn't. And he came to London, having worked his way down to London in various shows, and couldn't get a proper job as an actor. But he was employed as a super. This went on, you know, for a decade, shall we say, a good decade of his life. And he was odd. There was definitely something wrong with him mentally.
Mm.
He had a superiority complex and thought he was better than anyone else, but he wasn't. He wasn't a very good actor. And he would cause problems and eventually became unemployable. The word went out, don't employ Prince. You know, he's really mad Prince. And he had no money, fell on hard times, couldn't pay his rent, wrote off to various theatrical charities, and had worked also, he had worked with Terris on two or three melodramas as a super.
Yeah.
And got it into his head that it was Terris was holding his back, and it was Terris who was causing his failure to be a star.
Mm.
And the long and the short of it was that he eventually, he became manic, and decided that the only thing he could do, the correct thing to do, was to murder Terris, which he successfully did. And it was caused an absolute uproar. It was a sensational crime. He stabbed Terris to death as Terris was going to the theatre, stabbed him to death in Maiden Lane by the theatre at the stage door. And he was arrested immediately. Police station was just by Charing Cross. And he was put into custody. Terris died about half an hour later in his dressing room. He'd been carried up there. And there was nothing they could do about it.
Mm.
Anyway, he was tried and convicted and ended up in Broadmoor, where he stayed for the rest of his life. I think he died in the 1930s. So it was melodramatic, the whole thing, and it was seen in front of people. It was a crime of demented passion, I suppose. And one of the last words that Terris was heard to say was, "I will come back." Now, there'd already been a couple of premonitions about his murder.
Mm.
She had dreamed, his girlfriend at the time, he was married, but he had a leading lady, and she had dreamed that he had been struck down, and she had had a premonition about this. Other actors had as well, and within a few days, his spirit was seen at the theatre and caused a sensation. The whole thing was sensational because when he died at his funeral, I think there were 50,000 people turned up to see the funeral cortege go from Bedford Park to Brompton Cemetery, which is an enormous amount. So the whole thing caused a complete sensation, and sightings continued of him for a long time after his death. One of the strange ones, and a very strange one, was that he was actually sighted at Covent Garden Tube Station, which is very odd, because, I mean, an actor in those days wouldn't take the tube. He always took a hansom cab. They're rather like Sherlock Holmes. But he was, he's been reported to have been seen in the as recently as 1956 in the tube station, waiting for a tube, which is peculiar, to say the least. Now, so that's Terrace at the Adelphi.
I mean, it is remarkable. I mean, like I said at the beginning, Nick, Terrace is one of those people that I'm aware of primarily because of what happened and this self-created conspiracy that Price had created in his own mind. And the fact that, as we were discussing off air, essentially his death was front page news across the country. His fans were in mourning for weeks. People just couldn't believe what had happened. And I suppose it's probably one of the first examples of a celebrity death at the hands of some person who's created some kind of false narrative for them. And it is a real shame as well, because Terrace had actually helped Price get some funding, hadn't he, as well?
Oh, he had. He had been on he was on a couple of the theatrical charities, and on one of them he had definitely supported Prince and given him money. He'd made sure that they, and there was another, as it were, a mix-up, an awful mix-up, in that the secretary of one of the charities had refused Prince money, and he thought that was Terrace. And it wasn't at all. It was a mistake. He was mistaken. Awful.
Yeah.
It made as big an impression as say, you know, the murder of John Lennon.
Yeah, very much so. He was certainly a man of his time, wasn't he?
And I don't think any other actor of that status has been, as it were, murdered. I can't think of any who have had that fate.
Thankfully. I mean, it is a shocking.
Thankfully, yeah.
I mean, it's a shocking case in this day and age. Never mind, you know, in Victorian England when it occurred, because he was the, you know, a megastar
and above that sort of thing. I mean, okay, we have Jack the Ripper. Busy going about his business, but that was in Whitechapel. This not in the Adelphi, you know. The Adelphi in those days was the Shaftesbury Avenue of theatre. It was the great street for entertainment in Victorian London.
Incredible, and it's a great start to the book, because from that point onwards, you're kind of on the edge of your seat, as you were, because One of the great aspects of the book and the theatres that you discuss in it, Nick, is that you give us these historical anecdotes and take us back to these wonderful historical locations and give us a bit of an overview of it. But it's also the fact that it seems to span centuries. So from Terrace's unfortunate demise, one of the next stories that really caught my eye, primarily because I'm a big fan of the production, which is Wicked, is the unfortunate incident that occurred to a gentleman called George.
Yes, George. George, indeed. Poor George. Poor George. almost as bad as George, Duke of Clarence, you know, drowned in a butt of Malmsey. But the Victoria Palace is a very odd building, and one of the most haunted in London. I think it's a very weird building. I was there for a good 8-9 years when I was company manager on the first company manager on Starlight Express.
Yes.
And although I didn't see anything myself there, there were stories going around, but nothing which I could pinpoint. Apart from the lift, which was peculiar, and also there were some very peculiar people working there, so maybe they frightened off any spirits. But the theatre had been built up in that last sort of era of theatre building, which was immediately after the First World War, about 1928, from 28 to 30. So it's got a through foyer, and it was built as a cinema stroke variety house. And a very big seater. But underneath it, there are rivers in that area which run down to underground rivers which run down to the Thames. And the Apollo has to have a pump on permanently to stop the water rising. There were also, it was also used during the Second World War as a temporary mortuary for victims of the Blitz and the later bombings and V1 incidences which happened there. And that is definitely ever case. It doesn't appear spooky, but it's slightly inaccessible when you're backstage. There are only certain where you think you can get around, but you can't. It has a slightly strange atmosphere. Anyway, George, there's always someone on night duty. You have to, or for the insurance on a lot of theatres, they keep someone on overnight to make sure that there's, of course, again, going back to that story, you know, the great danger of theatre is fire. So, and the insurance often states you must have someone in attendance 24 hours a day to make sure that nothing untowards happens. But, you know, when they go off duty, and there's a couple of stories there about them, the cleaners come in. So the cleaners, so at the end of a show, popcorn, candy floss, programs, umbrellas, you name it, still drinks all over the place.
Yeah.
And who cleans it up? The cleaners. So the cleaners come on, but the cleaners are, they're gone by 10 in the morning. You never see them. You know, the sort of fairy hands come in and lift things and throw them in the bins. And George was the senior cleaner. And in my book, I related a couple of stories about presence in the auditorium. George was in the auditorium, checking the seats, checking the rubbish, picking it up, when he comes across a gentleman standing close to the ladies' toilets at the top of the left-hand run, as it were, and he points at George, and George's not quite sure if it's, who is this man? What's he doing in this, doing in the auditorium this time of the morning? You know, there's no rehearsals, there's no one should be here.
Yeah.
And then the man ran towards George and ran right through him. Now, that must be cardiac arrest time for the victim. George just screamed. He screamed and screamed and screamed and had to be carried out by the other cleaners. And he was off. He'd never work again alone in the auditorium.
Mm.
And that's a genuine story. Now, whether that apparition is the same person as two other stories which I relate, I don't know. But there's something nasty there, something nasty.
Yes.
Not just a musical. Something wicked. Sorry, there's something wicked there, and not just the musical.
Absolutely. It is a remarkable occurrence because it's very rare that we hear about such interactions with spirits anyway, Nick, because that's a very aggressive kind of presence. And as you say, poor George, it really did shock him to his core, as you say. And he was off work as well, wasn't he, with shock?
Yes, he was for a week. I mean, the thing is that there are instances of poltergeists throwing things at actors.
Yeah.
Usually prompt scripts saying tell it getting it right. But no, that's a joke. But but they do, you know, there are definitely instances of things flying through the air by an unseen hand, which are reported. But this sheer aggression, I think, is only matched in my book by the incident which happened in Bath on the play with Dame Anna Neagle, of fright, of absolute fright. I think a lot of people, a lot of the stories I've garnered are of people who have seen things, heard things, experienced things, but very few of them have chilled them to the bone.
Mm.
They thought, oh, what on earth was that? But they haven't been tremendously frightened. This is one of the really frightening ones.
Definitely. And like I say, it is a really strange encounter as well. And as you say, it is peculiar because with that kind of presence, you would suspect that more people would have had a comeuppance with it. But unfortunately, it seems that it just took an instant dislike to poor old George.
Yeah, yeah. There was an instance at the which I haven't fully reported, at Drury Lane, where Macklin's ghost is meant to haunt. If you go down underneath the stage, right to the bottom of the stage, into the basement, sub-basement of the theatre, there's a few bricks which actually date back to the original building.
Hmm.
Macklin wasn't there at the time, but he was there in the 1750s, 1760s. In fact, he supposedly lived until he was 101, but I'm not quite sure if that's absolutely correct. But he murdered, well, he got off with self-defense, or he got off with an act as a manslaughter. He killed another actor at the Lane, but stuck his cane through the man's eye, and it pierced his brain, and he died.
Yes.
And he was a contemporary of Garrick, Macklin, and a quarrelsome, big, braggadocio of an actor. Mm. Very good actor, wonderful Shylock, played some wonderful, wonderful Shakespearean parts. But a very difficult man indeed. And his presence, some people have said, although I haven't ever met one, that they feel his presence in these bottom corridors at the Lane. Now, whether that's true or not, I haven't got that down properly, because I never met somebody who could vouch for it. But that's a story. That Macklin is there. But again, a nasty presence, you know, a violent presence.
Mm, very much so. And I think the best thing to do, Nick, is to lighten the mood a little. And
All right.
One particular subject that's always interested me in the paranormal is animals. And there is a wonderful character in your book who is one of those wonderful eccentricities about the world of theatre, that some of them will have a house cat who is there to do the mousing more often than not and keep the areas free of pests. And there's a wonderful character who went by the name of Beerbon, who apparently his appearance mid-play would often be a sign of success or whatever, and he would occasionally grace the great and good of the British theatre scene with his affection on occasion. So who was Beerbon, and why was he so loved by so many?
Well, we have to go back. We have to go back about, I think, 20 years ago, I'd say, the last theatre cat, and I'm not talking of a musical, but a real cat, were eventually banished from theatres. All to do with elfin safety, I'm afraid. Elfin safety did them in. theatres are always overrun with mice, never rats. They're always mice, never rats. But, you know, I've seen so many in my time running along the back of seats, scuttling along the floors. But in the olden days, every theatre had a theatre cat. But health and safety literally put them out of business. And they got round it in a very clever way. They said, oh dear, you see, if we put down poison, the cat might eat it and die. And that would be so unfair, wouldn't it? Or words to that effect, you know, absolute rubbish. But anyway, that's how they got round it. So all these lovely old cats were put out to pasture. Now, before they were all put out to pasture, I should say, Beerbohm arrived at what used to be the Globe Theatre, is now the Gilgard Theatre, and he came, he was born at Her Majesty's Theatre, and the carpenter there gave him to Tony Ramsay, who was the master carpenter at the old Globe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I just say the old Globe is not the new Globe, which is, you know, where Shakespeare's done in the round and everyone gets rained on.
Yeah.
This is a proper theatre with a roof, Shaftesbury Avenue. Anyway, Tony took him in and he ruled the roost. He was a great character, wonderful character. And Tony had a little theatre for him underneath the stage, built up a little theatre for him to live in. But he wouldn't stay there. He was always going all around the building. Kept the mice down, of course, but he also enjoyed very much the company of castes. And he would nose out particular actors who he appreciated, come to their dressing rooms, would insist on being with them in their dressing rooms. Beryl Reid, who you may remember from The Killing of Sister George and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, she adored him, used to take him home at weekends to her house in the country and bring him back on Mondays. And everyone, Maggie Smith, a lot of actors loved Beerbohm. But he didn't just stay backstage, he'd also go on stage, and he would walk on stage quite often during a show. And of course, everyone loved it. The audience loved it. And they love a genuine mistake if they can see it. Mm. And that's the secret of, you know, if you have a corpse, you know, when people laugh involuntarily because of something going wrong, as long as the audience can hear what's going wrong or see what's going wrong, it brings the house down.
Yes.
And the Oboe's entrance would, of course, bring the house down. And sometimes it was actually used, if they had a show with cats in it and the cat didn't turn up that night or wouldn't appear, the Oboe would be taken on stage and used in his place. But he'd also, he could be a bit naughty. He could rather damage the set, you see, after the show. There was a show called The Rear Column by Simon Gray. And it's about a British expedition into the Congo, darkest Africa, and they're picked off one by one. And the set was magnificent. It was a jungle. You know, it was equatorial Africa. And the designer was Eileen Dis, great designer, and very authentic. And she got all these wonderful stuffed birds, which she put around the set. And they forgot about Beerbohm. And they dressed the set the night before. They came in the next day, and all which was left was a pile of feathers all over the stage. Not a lot of them. So that there you are. That's Beerbohm. Paul Beerbohm passed away. Well, he didn't pass. He was retired, went off to live with Tony, and then he passed away. Mm. And about 2013, we were doing a show called Strangers on a Train, which was the a stage adaptation of the Hitchcock film. And anyway, it was a long evening, a very good play, but a long evening. And I was company manager, and plays have maybe four or five performances when you work through technically. And Strangers on a Train was very complicated because you'd have a revolve which swung round, excellent set, but it would swing round to various sets. So all this took timing. There were scene changes which had to be done in seconds. So it was a technical nightmare, the best way to describe it. But we got it done. I mean, put it this way, to make it understandable, the interval change where we had to strike from one set to another, when we first did it, it took 35 minutes. By the time we got to opening night, and this is the interval, got it down to 5 minutes. So that's what can be achieved. So pushing backwards, as it were, I sat down in the auditorium to watch a stagger through, knowing that we'd come up against some technical problems, which we would have to stop, and knowing that's going to be a long evening. So I sat there, and as I sat there, I was on the aisle seat with my legs out, and I felt something go past it. Now, I think I've said before about all theatres having mice and the rat word. I can't say that, but it's R-A-T. And I thought, oh, my God, what's that? I thought, that's a bloody great R-A-T, or even a bloody great mouse. So I just go and investigate this, stood up, walked through the back. And I just saw, as I turned to go up to the exit, I saw a tail waving. That is a really big tail. So I followed up, went round the corner, nothing in the auditorium. But there on the wall was a photograph, and in it, with its tail, was Beerbohm. I'm sure it was a cat which brushed past me. There's no doubt about it. It wasn't a mouse or a rat.
Yeah. Has Beerbohm been seen by other people?
No, that was the first and, as far as I know, the only time.
Well, it was nice of him to pop by and say hello.
Well, it may have been the play. He may have gone, he may have been watching for some time and given up.
Yeah, everyone's a critic, Nick. Everyone's a critic.
Yes, everyone's a critic. Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it was quite spooky, because I literally, you know how you feel something going past your leg?
Yes.
You know? And then seeing this tail, something, an animal, going out the back.
Oh, brilliant.
And I recall that I had forgotten all about Beerbohm, because it had been 5 years.
Mm.
6 years since he'd gone.
Mm. Well, maybe that's why he came back, just to remind you of his presence.
Maybe.
Yeah, just to gently give you a gentle nudge, Nick, in remembrance.
Yes. At least he didn't claw me.
Yes, well, yes, exactly. Exactly.
Worse ways, or lifted his leg. That would have been terrible. That would have been terrible.
Yes,
mind you, that he could have done that. No, I won't go into that. No.
Yes, it could have been bad for both you and the play, I suspect.
Bad for business. Bad for business. There's a nasty smell in the auditorium. Well, there's many a nasty smell in an auditorium.
Very true. I think one of the other wonderful stories features one of Britain's most beloved actors from stage and screen for countless decades, Nick, which is Thora Hird. This one is a very interesting story because it's one of the few in the book that features what would seem to be a haunted item that has randomly found itself being part of a play.
Indeed. It's a very odd story altogether. It was, how the best way to describe it? I'll start off with, there used to be a theatre. There is still a theatre. In fact, the theatre where I trained at, which was the old Embassy Theatre in Swiss Cottage, which is part of the Central School. And in the early 50s, it was still a theatre, a commercial theatre. And so it was 1949, approximately, probably through to 1950. But Thora Hird was in a play called The Queen Came By at the Embassy Theatre, which is, as I said, where the Central School is now based.
Hmm.
And they decided, it did very well, and they decided to transfer it to the Duke of York's, which is on St. Martin's Lane. It was a period piece, and it had been produced as inexpensively as possible in those austere days at the embassy. So everything had been, you know, found on, you know, markets and furniture, second-hand shops, etc. And one of the pieces was several of the costumes had been bought from stalls. And one of them, specifically for Thora Hird, was a Victorian lady's jacket embossed. What we used to call, I don't know if you still call it, a bum freezer, because it stopped, you know, just on top of the bum. And so it could be worn with a bustle, if you see what I mean, like those Victorian ladies wore, you know, riding. So they open, everything goes well, they open at the Duke of York's, and Thora appears, and night after night, and as the run continues, goes into weeks, she begins to feel constrained by this jacket. Seems to be getting tighter. So it's let out by the wardrobe. You know, the sleeves, the back is let out, the sleeves are loosened, but it still gets tighter and tighter. And she feels that it's really, also, it's getting very tight around the neck, top of her chest.
Mm.
Well, one night she's off, and her understudy goes on, and she had exactly the same sensation. And she felt that something was pushing on her neck, and she then stated to the rest of the company she had seen someone in the wings wearing an identical jacket. Now, this was, you know, everyone, oh, yes, yeah, sure, been on the gym, dear, and all that, you know, carry on. But yeah. No. Anyway, everyone thought this is very odd, but there's something wrong with this jacket.
Mm.
So the stage manager, a brave lady, she stepped forward and tried it on, and she too felt this strangulation, feeling of strangulation on her neck from the jacket. So she took it off, and the director said, well, this is peculiar. Freddie Piffard, his name was. And he said, I'll get my wife to try it. That's what, how directors direct you, so you get the actor to do it. And the same thing happened to her, and it was all awful, and, you know, she had hysterics. So everyone was getting very concerned. They felt there was, which is, it sounds bizarre, but there was something the jacket was causing people to feel as if they were being strangled.
Mm.
Now, this swept through the company, and it caused a lot of alarm, and actors are very superstitious people. And so they called in Fred Archer, who was an investigative journalist and a very knowledgeable in the world of psychic phenomena.
Mm.
And he arranged for a seance. And he got not one, not two, but three mediums. And they did it on stage at the end of a show. And the mediums believed or felt that there was a presence there, and they could feel hands or see hands being put around someone's neck. So there was absolutely, you know, bedlam. And the next thing which happened was that they tried again with someone else, and again they had hysterics. And it got to a point where Archer had to stop the seance. He said, this is, you know, it's getting out of control, this mass hysteria. So he dismissed the company. They stayed in the theatre, he and his mate, and they went down to try and find someone who had no experience of the experience. And they found a couple walking across Trafalgar Square. This is late, you know, this is about midnight, just after midnight. No one there, apart from this couple. And they spoke to the couple, and they agreed to come back with them to the theatre and see what, you know, and help them, which they did. The girl put on the jacket, didn't feel anything, fair enough. But the young man had a very different, reaction. He put his right hand once, he said that something, he put his hand out and touched his girlfriend and said that something is making me want to squeeze and squeeze hard. And his hands went up to her neck, and they had to pull them off to stop him from, as it were, strangling her. So she then put the jacket on. They pulled him off. She put the jacket on, and she said that someone is something's trying to squeeze me again. So the whole thing, you know, was extraordinary. So they stopped the experiment, and the woman had said there was something sinister, like death. It feels as if someone was trying to kill me, but in a just way, which is very odd.
Yes.
Anyway, so he was convinced that, Archer was convinced that there was something had happened to someone in this jacket, and that it was, as it were, possessed. And they told the management got rid of the jacket. What happened to it, I don't know, but it was supposedly sold to America, and someone in America may still have the jacket in their wardrobe. Let's hope they're not wearing it.
Yeah, I did like that bit, that the fact of how to deal with this alleged possessed jacket was to sell it on.
Sell it on. I mean, you'd think someone, you know, you'd throw it in the furnace, but no, they sold it on.
Yes, yeah.
But that's the theatre for you, you know. I mean, you've got to get rid of all your assets, you know, at the end of a show. even if they're murderous.
absolutely. Never waste a penny, Nick.
Never waste a penny. It is. I mean, I'm sorry, I haven't told that. Haven't told it particularly well. But it is a very, very strange, story. Because there were so many witnesses to it. This is the thing.
Yes.
And it wasn't, and so many people tried it on and had the same experience. That is what's remarkable.
Yeah. Especially the young couple who they just stumble across as well, because like you say, that kind of would work into what Fred was suggesting, that perhaps everybody was suffering from some kind of mass panic.
Mass hysteria, but then these people came along and the same thing happened to them.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. It's very strange as well that, like I say, in the book, the majority of experiences that you relate to us are people seeing things or feeling things, and yet this... It's just a very creepy story, because it's just a jacket, isn't it?
It's just a jacket, yes. Yes, sitting on a coat hanger.
Yeah.
Waiting to strangle you.
Well, there is another interesting story about another object in the book, which I'd like to touch on, which is the story that involves the picture in the Garrick Club. And the fact that someone didn't seem to be very happy with it.
No, that's extraordinary, because David Garrick, of course, is England's most famous actor. You know, I mean, his reputation has survived ever since his death in 1779. And he was a revolutionary actor, and his fame still still lasts today. And that's why the club was formed 50 years after his death. He was still that famous that they named the club after him. Anyway, I tried to find, I thought it would be very fitting to find if Garrick did haunt anywhere. Mm. And I could find no stories in any theatre. Well, there's only Drury Lane, of course, where his company worked, and that's how I first came about Mr. Garrick, because I'm with the Drury Lane Theatrical Fund, which was founded by Garrick in 1766, and we celebrate every year the Baddeley Cake, which is another story. So Garrick is very important to us because he founded this, the oldest theatrical charity in existence in the world. And he certainly doesn't haunt the lane. I'm sure of that. There's been never any accounts of him being seen there.
Mm.
Unlike Macklin's presence, for example, or Dan Leno, or Grimaldi, or other people. And so I'd practically given up. And then a friend of mine, I was at the Garrick Club, and I was asking around, and they said, well, yeah, there is a story. One of the members is a very distinguished writer called Brian Masters.
Mm.
And he said, the secretary told me, Brian has a story about David Garrick. So I said, oh, yes. Do you think I could, you know, ask him? He said, yes, go on, go and ask him. So I did. And Brian told me this story, in that the Garrick has a magnificent staircase which goes from the foyer, as it were, on the ground floor, up to the first floor where the bar is. And it's a very beautiful staircase, Victorian, very wide, and it's got and there's a rotunda above it, a dome, with light coming down, and it's the walls are lined with beautiful pictures, portraits of famous actors, all the way down. And Brian thought he would love to get a painted picture of the staircase with the pictures all the way coming down to the entrance foyer. So he commissioned an artist, and a guy called, I don't know if you remember that Windsor Castle burst into flames years ago. Do you remember the Annus Horribilis?
Yes.
The Queen, I think, if that's the right right pronunciation. And when the fire was put out, there was a watercolourist called Alexander Creswell. I think he's a watercolourist, came along and did some wonderful pictures of the ruins, as it were, of the charred remains.
Yes.
And
yes.
Brian was very taken by this man's work. So he commissioned him to do this picture. And he had one from the bottom of the stairs. He wanted one of the bottom part and one of the top part of the stairs. And the best way to place this for the artist was to be halfway up, so he could look to the left and look to the right for his two portraits, for his two paintings. So it was arranged that he'd set up his easel there and do it. And he did two excellent watercolours. Now, the position he was standing in, as you go up the stairs, there is a small landing. And on one of them, on the first small landing, there is an antique chair. Now, this antique chair belonged to David Garrick. It was his own, one of his own chairs from his house. And it was purchased by the club, you know, 150 years ago, and sits in pride of place. No one can sit in it. Has a please do not disturb, but it's, you know, please don't sit on it sign. It's very delicate. But to accommodate the easel, it had to be taken away. And anyway, man does his pictures. Brian's delighted. So he decides to, he asks the secretary, could I display one of them so all the members could see it? And so a position is placed at the top of the stairs on the top landing by the bar, by the balustrade, and the picture is on view there. Now, the club is closed the weekend. When they come back on Monday, the staff find the picture at the bottom of the stairs in pieces, lying, oh, its frames in pieces. What on earth's happened? And they go up and they check, and it was if the picture had jumped out of its standing display easel and jumped over the balustrade and out, and there was no one there. This is the thing. It had been checked on the Saturday night, and in those days, the whole building was locked, barred, shuttered. No one was in attendance. So there was no one there. This is before the days of security cameras, but no one was in the building. And no one could understand how this accident had happened. So Brian had it sent off to be repaired. And as the guy came to collect the picture from the from restorers, he said to Brian, "Oh, so the ghost's been at it again, has he?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, it's, never mind, it's heard about it." Off he went. Brian thought about it. He thought, "What does he mean?" And then logic swung into action, and he realised, because there was no other explanation apart from some force had thrown this picture over the balustrade and down, that the one thing missing in that picture was Garrick's chair, because the artist had done the painting exactly where the chair stands, so it couldn't be in view. So Brian's theory, which I willingly accept, is that Mr. Garrick was so angry that his chair wasn't on view in the painting that he made it crash from the top of the landing to the foyer below.
Oh.
It's bizarre.
It is.
There's no other explanation. Because there was no wind, there was no one there. No one would have done a deed such as that. Who else?
Yeah, who else but Mr. Garrick? Clearly.
Mr. Garrick.
Annoyed that his chair.
It's not in the picture. How dare they? How dare they? I'll have them.
It is one of those strange things because, as you say, the position of the picture from what we're led to believe and how it was displayed. And it would have to have been thrown to have ended up where it would. It couldn't have just dropped off. And if it is, it would have just fallen to the floor, would it not, Nick?
If by some chance, if it toppled forward, it would have just landed on the carpet. On the floor the easel was at. But it sailed down a good 30 foot to a tiled floor. I rest my case.
It is interesting when occasionally things like that occur in haunted locations where someone perhaps does something that they think is a nice testament or a tribute to a venue, Nick, and the resident spirit doesn't seem to agree with that opinion.
Doesn't want it, no.
Oh, remarkable. I think the last character I want to touch on, Nick, if that's all right with you, sir.
Indeed.
Is, of course, the legendary performer Grimaldi. Primarily because I was shocked when I was reading your book to hear, because we don't think about these things in this modern age of stuntmen and stunt doubles and sprung stages and crash mats and things, that when you had performers like Grimaldi, they essentially were just bashing themselves to pieces night after night for an audience's entertainment.
Yeah, it was the hardest. People say, oh, it's tough. It's a tough profession, but they don't know what tough is compared to what they had to put themselves through, especially if you were a comedian or a clown, which Grimaldi was both. You know, he was a great, great comic, a great mime, a great pantomime, you know, figure. It just, the sheer physicality of it, and of course it was physical. Everything had to be big and loud, and the more brutal it was, the the more the audience laughed, because they were a brutal lot, Georgian audiences. You know, they liked to, if you did a slapstick, you got slapped.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And you fell, you know. I mean, I suppose the nearest example is, I suppose, you know, the only thing we can sort of equate it with today is to watch, you know, the silent comedies, you know, especially like Buster Keaton,
who, yes,
in a way, had the same magic, but physical stunts he did were extraordinary, and Grimaldi did the same. You know, he was a wonderful acrobat as well as a clown,
yeah,
you know, a clownish acrobat. And as I think you're going to say, it all came to an early end, yeah, which is terribly sad. Yeah,
I mean, it is remarkable when you look at when you read the passage about Grimaldi, that obviously his popularity, he was wildly popular with Georgian audiences, as you pointed out, Nick, that he would run on his famous legs of steel, as they were known,
yep,
from theatre to theatre to do numerous performances on the same day, which,
yep,
is one of those things that would obviously only add to his physical ailments as he got older.
Yeah, he could do it. I think he could do it from Sadler's Wells to Drury Lane in about 8 minutes, I think, without checking my stopwatch. I think I'm pretty sure he did. He was just 8 minutes from Sadler's Wells to Drury Lane. Now that's running, isn't it? That's amazing.
Especially in that day and age where you're having to dodge piles of horse manure and horses and carts.
Oh, yes.
And drunkards.
Yes, yes, yes. He did like a drink himself. That's,
yes,
anything. But they all did. I mean, they all did. They lived on it. You know, they lived on strong liquor. Kept him going.
I would imagine he had to run in full makeup as well, would he not, Nick?
Probably, yes. Probably, yes. Probably had a... He may have had another costume at the other end.
He may have
just, you know, left his slap on, as they say,
yes,
and run down the... Yeah, I hope so. Otherwise, it'd be... And he was, of course... I'm very proud to say that his last performance in front of an audience, it was a benefit which we, the Drury Lane Theatrical Fund, set up for him.
Yes.
So I'm very, very, we're very proud of that we looked after him until the end.
Yeah, because I think he was only 48 at that point, wasn't he? And he was,
yep,
essentially a broken,
yep,
man.
Completely couldn't walk. Had to be carried on stage. I mean, just everything had gone, you know.
Mm. Goodness me. It does show you that, yeah, people just don't realise how easy things are. And as you touched on, I'm still astounded, even in this day and age, when we look back at the beginning of last century, Nick, as you say, about Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd and others of that ilk, that the actual work that they did, I mean, you look at some of the production photos and things, and Keaton and Lloyd are, you know, hanging off by their fingertips off things, and it is baffling that we look back at something filmed 100 years ago and essentially people were just getting seriously injured making silent films
and doing it all for real.
Yes,
you know? I mean the most famous one of Keaton, of course, is the front of a house falling down.
Yes,
and if he'd been, you know, 2 inches out, he'd have been dead.
Yes.
That's one of them. But there were other extraordinary, if you see some of the stunts in the general, there were no doubles. He did them all live.
Yes.
And the falls, you know, continually falling down, pratfalls, you know, backfalls, extraordinary.
Yeah, it is remarkable. And it's a sad story, but it's also, I suppose, inspiring as well that, you know, 250 years later, people still know the name Grimaldi.
Yes, and of course, Joey is a clown.
Yeah,
and they have a service. The clowns have a service each year for him, a memorial service, and he's buried, of course, in London. He's buried, you know, in on the way up to Islington.
Yes.
Fascinating guy, and I'm in awe. Sorry, I'm in awe of him, because I think he was just unique. He must have been unique to have seen on stage. And I don't know. We have no comparison these days. I don't think so. No.
No, definitely not. It really is a different era, especially when you consider everything like that, Nick. It just shows you the lengths people would go to just to entertain the public.
Yeah. Or and be expected to.
Absolutely. Night after night after night.
Yep.
Well, I have to say, Nick, as I said at the beginning, it's a wonderful book. I recommend it highly. It's full of witty stories, factual tidbits, things I never even heard of. The story about Errol Flynn doing some Amdram is remarkable because Flynn's one of those characters that obviously 70, 80 years on, his name is still mentioned in reverence in the world of acting. And obviously, as a big fan of David Niven's autobiographies, he lived with Flynn.
Yes, he would always let you down. That's what Niven said, didn't
he? Yes. You can always rely on Errol because he'll always let you down.
Now, of course, his boat, the Zarka.
Yes.
When I was a kid, my aunt and uncle lived in Mallorca at the time, in Palma, and they were in a film with him, King's. I think it was King's Rhapsody, which he and Anna Neagle did a film for Herbert Wilcox,
yes.
And they filmed some of it in Palma, and his boat, the Zarka, was moored there, and I remember seeing it. Schooner. And there is a story of it being later on, after he died, it was in Cannes or Antibes, I'm not quite sure, but there is a ghost story about the boat with him in it. But I couldn't put that on because it wasn't a theatre.
Ah, interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah. Ah, the haunted
marvelous.
Boat.
Yeah, well.
But I'm not surprised after what went on it. So.
Yeah, that's not the kind of haunting people want to see, Nick, I suspect.
No, maybe, or no.
Or here even, goodness. God only knows what's going on that boat.
But sadly, he doesn't haunt Northampton. Well, no one's seen it. So, you see, this is what I find fascinating about the whole business of theatre ghosts, is that they can be infuriating, because you think, oh, he's bound to haunt somewhere. No, he doesn't, you know. I mean, John Gielgud, for example, you'd think Sir John would come back, but not a glimpse anywhere.
Yeah, and like you say there, you would expect certain people to be in certain locales, but that's the other thing. There's several theatres that you cover in the book where the person that's most associated with that particular theatre doesn't actually haunt that particular theatre.
No. No, a few of them do, but I won't say which, but they do.
Absolutely, you have to buy the book to find out.
They are mentioned, yes.
So, Nick, as you refer to this, I mean, this is the first book, and I can only hope that there is a second volume, because it is a wonderful collection of stories. It's witty, it's funny, it's engaging. There's some very creepy stories, as George the Cleaner will attest to. But there's also lots of real nuggets of trivia and history in there. So it's a wonderful book, and I congratulate you on it. I found it thoroughly enthralling.
Oh, thank you. And I wouldn't have. I don't think I'd have written it unless I'd experienced a few instances myself. And I think that was important, because I thought then, once I started to collect stories, I thought, no, I may not be alone.
Mm.
There are other people who've had experiences which they cannot be proved, but they cannot be disproved, because they happen to so many people under so many different circumstances, but never when you're waiting for them to happen, I find.
Yes.
I find that nearly all the stories I've never come across, for example, a story, but I haven't put them in, of people deliberately going out to try and find something.
Yes.
And finding it. All the stories I relate are spontaneous happenings.
Yeah. And I think that gives a bit more of a realistic grounding as well, because a lot of these people are just going about their day-to-day chores in the theatre. They're working when these things happen.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I think shocks a lot of them.
Yes.
The fact that the fact that it is so unexpected and so inexplicable.
Yeah. Well, it's a remarkable book, a wonderful collection of stories, theatres and locales. And like I say, I really do hope there's a second volume soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
So where can everybody get themselves a copy, Nick, and follow your work?
My book, Stage Ghosts and Haunted Theatres, is available at lmpbooks.co.uk, or just look up the title. Also at Amazon, and also at selected bookshops such as the Atlantis Bookshop, Watkins, any good bookshop will supply it to you.
And I recommend it highly. Nick, you've been a wonderful guest. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining me on Mysteries and Monsters, and you are always welcome, sir.
Thank you, Paul. And thank you for having me on your show.